there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today, for you anyway, is Thursday, October the 3rd, 2024, and I'm speaking to you from the past, from Monday of this same week, where I cut this show in for you guys. That way, I had enough content from expert council members. The Piker tree has dropped much fruit in the past month. And once kids go back to school and all, it seems like the piking, except for Ken Berry, goes away. anyway, I got a good lineup of people for you guys today. Dan McAdams and Dr. Paul will talk about how Zelensky has a victory plan. But I'm with them. I think it's basically one last big grift, because his victory plan is, hey, you guys fight the war for us and we'll win. That's basically his plan. We'll hear about that in a minute. Andy McCann sent me a ton of content when he joined the expert council, and I'm working through a pretty good backlog. So this is actually from a while ago, but he's got a segment today on when you're exercising on like a lion diet or a carnivore diet, and people are like, but don't you need carbs to be able to exercise? The answer is no, and I'll let him explain it. Sean Mills will talk about setting up basic backup power with batteries and an inverter, like to run the most essential things, like a refrigerator, you know, and a few lights and some things like that, and how you can actually do that. Now, some of these solar generators that both of us really despise in the way that they're marketed sometimes actually do have a valid way that they can be used. And this would be actually the one of the things that they would be good at for temporary backup so that you can get everything running and then get the generator out, right? So it's just kind of a short-term duration solution that he's looking for. And so we'll have Sean talk about that. Carrie Brown will talk about foraging for the stinky but wonderful ginkgo. It's a pretty interesting fruit or nut, really. And even though they stink like god-awful nastiness, it's the flesh that stinks. The seed is the edible part, and it doesn't smell bad at all once you take care of it. Ken Daniels will give you a lesson in mixology and health elixirs with vermouth. And when I say a lesson, I'm talking about a historical lesson going back in time, kind of Professor CJ meets mixology type of segment from Ken. Those of you who will be here at the workshop will get to meet Ken. He'll be running a bagel bar for you on the first day. Doc Bones will talk about monkeypox, should you even care, and what is it and what isn't it. And then I'm going to do a segment on dealing with broody chickens or ducks, because it doesn't really matter. It could be geese, could be anything. When you want the birds to do the work of brooding for you, but you have a problem in that you only want so many eggs hatched, and what will often happen with the broody is other birds realize she's broody, and they'll go pop eggs under her. They'll even relieve her for a little bit so she can go out and do her thing, and when they sit down, they're going to drop a few eggs and take off and leave them for someone else to do the mama part. So this results in problems. And the person that asked the question was trying to figure out how to know if an egg was fertilized or not. If you're keeping roosters with your chickens, they're all fertilized. And we'll talk about why that's, because it seems like maybe he's worried about that. That's not something to worry about if you're collecting eggs daily. But how do we separate it? It's really a simple solution that we came up with, and I'll drop that on you at the end of today's episode. Real quick, because I'm doing this so many days in advance, I don't have like an item of the day or anything like that today. I'm not doing any sponsor segments today. I just will remind you, if you want to help this show out, there's a number of ways you can do that. One is when you are going to shop online, especially either Vavor or Amazon, if you could just go to tspaz.com first and start with my links there. If you're using Vavor, you get a discount code and use on anything. Amazon, you don't get a discount code, but you're helping me out just by go into that page and clicking a link from there before you buy what you're going to buy anyway. The other thing is Home Food Systems, the courses I sell there, that doesn't just help me. That helps Tom, the web guy, who does all this dadgone work, because when we built that site, I finally had a way to key him in as a major revenue partner. So when you buy a course from Home Food Systems, some of that money comes to me, but some of it goes to pay Tom. And to me, that makes all the time and effort that he puts in to help us here really pay off for him finally. I'm really trying to work things out eventually between what I can do with him as a partner and maybe getting him some other customers that eventually, hopefully, he'll be able to do his own thing and do it however the hell he wants. And so I really hope that works out for him. So I just want you to know that you're not just supporting the show. You're supporting one of the key people who helps me keep this show on the air. Because you guys think I'm technical. If you want to make Tom laugh, tell him what a technical genius Jack Spirko is, and he'll laugh you out the room. There's a possibility that Tom will be at TSP 24. We'll see. He has an open invitation anytime to events like that, but I don't know whether he's going to be able to come or not, so some of y'all will get to meet him. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Dan McAdams and Dr. Paul on Zelensky's victory plan. Should we believe him? I don't think so. Here you go.
Zelensky scouts a victory plan.
Yeah, he's got a plan.
Oh, we better look at that. Turns out it doesn't sound like a victory. It sounds like desperation.
Yeah.
Can we get the last money out of the American taxpayers? He put me down as a skeptic.
Yeah. So he came to town. He was up at the UN General Assembly. Well, before that, he was in Scranton, Pennsylvania. We talked about that yesterday, touring an arms factory. So he comes to town. You can put that first one on because, Dr. Paul, you talked about it. So he comes to town, and he has the victory plan that Biden demanded from him. But the victory plan itself, Dr. Paul, is more of the same. And I will summarize it. I don't even need a clip. Give me more money, number one. I need more weapons, long-range weapons. Give me permission to strike deeply into Russia with these long-range weapons. And this is the best one. Immediate NATO membership for all of Ukraine, including the Article 5 guarantees, i.e., if Russia does anything in the war zone that it's currently winning, then the rest of NATO will come in and fight my battle for me. And my note to myself was, well, why not a no-fly zone as well? Because this is basically everything that he's been saying for the entire time. You give me everything, you go to war for me, and we'll win.
It's so bewildering to me how people who have stupid policies, evil policies, policies that violate our Constitution, we can't afford them, and we usually end up losing overall.
I completely agree with Dr. Paul on this. Yeah, call me a skeptic, because I am. I'm incredibly skeptical that there is any plan that Ukraine has for victory, because it's not possible. You can give them all the money and weapons you want to now, and the reality is very, very simple. They don't have enough people to field into the battlefield now. They've lost over 500,000 men. A whole generation butchered and damned, like the song. A whole generation butchered and damned. For no gain. And they have about another 500,000 that are so wounded that they cannot return to the front. And nobody's left that wants to fight. Everything is down to conscripts now. No one's joining. No one's signing up. People are doing everything they can to escape conscription. And they're being violently beaten when they're caught trying to leave their own country because they don't want to fight in a war. That's the situation on the ground. Whether you like it or not, whether you hate Putin or not, I don't care. It doesn't matter. The facts are the facts. And I'm going to tell you, people like Trump says he can end the war. He can. And it's a very simple thing to do, but it's not a simple thing to say leading up to an election because people don't want to hear how you end the war. But I'm going to tell you exactly how you end this war. In about 24 hours, you go to Zelensky and you say, okay, I'm in charge now, and here's what's going to happen. No more money. No more money, no more weapons, no more open checkbook, no more. You don't get any more. Unless... I will help you with your defense, your legitimate needs of defending your territory. Which, by the way, the territory you lost isn't yours. The people that live there voted to not be part of Ukraine. That's not coming back. I'm sorry, it should have never happened, but it did. The only way that we'll do anything to support you going forward is you and the Russians get together at a negotiating table right now and you seriously negotiate for a peace in good faith from both sides. And if you don't do that, you'll get absolutely f-all nothing. This isn't much different, though it's a different situation, on how Nixon campaigned on ending the Vietnam conflict. He said he had a secret plan to end the war. And the secret plan to end the war was stop fighting a war that's not our war. That was Nixon's plan. Do you know why he didn't say it? Because he wouldn't have got reelected. That's why. Because he wouldn't have got reelected. And that was the only way to end the war, and he held off until he was reelected. That's how simple this is. You end wars by not engaging in wars that you should not be engaging in the first place. Anyway, I'm sure that makes me anti-Ukraine or anti-democratic or a tool of Putin or whatever. Anyway, let's talk about the lion diet, which is basically a very strict form of the carnivore diet, and how that affects your ability to train and work out.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage out here in Woodstock, Georgia, and I have a question from my family. We did a family reunion up in Kapakoi for Labor Day weekend, and we got into talking about carnivore and how to eat and how to exercise, because, well, that's my thing. And the basic question was, Andy, I hear you're doing this harder carnivore thing called the lion diet. What is that? And once I described it to them, they're like, how can you even work out doing that? So I thought I would bring that to you guys. And the big thing I'd like to, I guess, shout out is, if you guys know Dr. Ken Berry, he has a YouTube channel, and he is an expert counsel here. Go to his page, his YouTube channel. It's Ken D. Berry, M.D., and he goes through all of this stuff. He's huge into carnivore. He actually has interviewed Michaela Peterson. So, guys, huge shout out to him. I've been watching all his stuff. My son got hit with a Crohn's diagnosis, so we're doing the lion diet. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that. And more importantly, how do you work out with that? Because it is weird and different. And they were maybe not odd. They thought I was an idiot. But we talked about it anyway. Okay, so you're doing this carnivore diet. You're eating a lot of protein and fats, very little carbs. You heard Jack talk about this. Basically, you're going to maybe in ketosis, maybe not. It depends on the level of carbs that you've got. But with this lion diet, it's really just salt, water, and ruminant meat. So deer, cow, bison, elk, things like that, right? So it's a red meat, salt, and water. We do add in things as Evan is allowed to or finds that he can. So he eats a lot of coconut. I don't really like coconut, so I can, but I don't. We added in some goat cheese. But anyway, I am working out at doing CrossFit with this diet, so pretty much zero carbs. And they're like, how does it work? Is it even possible? Here's the cool thing. Because I've been doing CrossFit for so long, I know exactly how I perform in different workouts. We log and track and measure everything. I also work out with the same people all the time. So when they said 3, 2, 1, go, and we do a thing, let's say it was running, pull-ups, and squats, right? That's what we're doing. We have 15 minutes of it. The first minute, I feel pretty good. The second minute, I feel like crap. And what's happening is, and I've gone through this before, when I got off of sugar and bread a long time ago, this happened to me. And the same thing was occurring, except a little bit more dramatic. Basically, your body has to relearn how to burn fuel. And I really, the only thing I've got is fat, and it just burns differently. Now, the interesting thing was, I could still work out pretty dang close to my workout partners. So, Joe, Mike, and those guys, they weren't going that much faster, stronger, or whatever than me. They're a little bit, but not much. And I could see them right there. I'm like, that's interesting. I feel really weird, but I'm moving okay. And at the end of it, I could look at my time, mark it down, and then track it with something that I did before and see that I'm only seconds off or maybe pounds off. So it's not a huge gap. So yes, it does change how you work out. But no, it doesn't really affect it like massively enough to say, you can't do CrossFit or you can't do intensity. So here's the other thing. There's a race we do over here through Warrior Adventure Racing. It's called the Blairsville Extreme. I should have pulled that up. But Blairsville Extreme Adventure Race. It's a 10-hour race in the woods. So this would have been my fourth or fifth week on this lion diet. So basically just proteins and fats. I also brought just proteins and fats for the race. And I was a little concerned. 10 hours in the woods, run, bike, and canoe with a map and a compass. And my teammate does the normal stuff. So he had let some of his conditioning slack. So like, all right, whatever. We'll go out and give it a try. He's not going to be doing great. I'm not going to be doing great. We'll see. Turns out I did have a little bit of issue. I had a little bit of cramping. So I had to make sure I got enough salt and electrolytes. And I did use coffee to kind of pep me back up. But for two old guys, we came in first place. And there was more than just one team. So we didn't just beat ourselves. We beat some of the first place for the old guys, not first place overall. First place for the old guys, so over 50, right? And anyway, my point to you is this. You can work out without carbs. And it blew my cousins away. They're like, I don't think that's true. I'm like, well, I'm doing it. So if you guys are nervous, you're like, yeah, I do this training, I'm not really sure, and I want to keep it has nothing to do with it. Yes, you will feel weird because you're burning a different energy, but you're going to get the same effect from the exercises you're doing. So keep exercising. Give it a try. It's been awesome to see the changes for Evan. I actually enjoy eating this way. But anyway, my big thing for you is give it a shot. You can do it. If you go to the page I'm looking at right here is liondiet.com. You can see Michaela Peterson's, all her experience. It's awesome. If you go to Dr. Ken Berry's YouTube page, you'll see all of his articles. This is great stuff. All right. Something else that I'm going to throw at you is I finally did do a thing to be online with you guys. So I had some friends say, hey, what about all those guys that leave your gym or other gyms and have a home gym? What do they do? How do they have community? And I was like, well, I'm the type of guy that if I can solve a problem, I try to. I'm an engineer. I like to solve stuff. So I teamed up with a buddy of mine, Brandon Phillips, who was a CrossFit Games competitor and has his own gym down the street from me and does a lot of programming. So we put together it's called Garage Fitness Online. So I'll give the link to Jack. Jack, if you want to put it in there. If you guys want to become part of our new community that's developing, it's right here. We're going to use some cool tools, have good programming. And I probably should have done this a long time ago for you guys. It didn't really occur to me to actually do what I do, but online. I don't know why. Anyway, it's another case of Jack, you jerk. There's a business just looking me in the face and I'm not even looking at it. We're going to launch this on September 8th. I think that's when the legal and the insurance gets done. I know you always have to have legal and insurance. So if you want to participate, the link will be there. It's called Garage Fitness Online. You can go on Facebook and find our page, or you can go on the internet and find us. Right now, our landing page is actually just off of my normal gym's page. Of course, you can always find me on YouTube at AndyMcCann42. Or listen to our podcast. It's called Fitness, Food, and Finances, and it's on all the podcast apps. All right, guys, if you have questions about how to exercise in this diet, don't hesitate to email me. But I promise you, if you listen to Ken Berry, listen to his videos, this stuff's going to work great for you. Take care.
Well, I come at this a little bit different on the approach. When anybody tells me something like, but, you know, you have to do this thing, in this case, you know, you need carbs to be able to train. I always start off with, okay, that's an interesting opinion. Why do you believe that? Right? Why do you believe that? Not what do you believe. Why do you believe it? Where did you get that information from? And inevitably, it will be everybody knows. Don't you think that everybody knows is not a valid way to define something as being factual or not factual? So where do you get this information? What scientific study, what article that's not an opinion piece, it's factually based, what testing has ever been done to show that a person cannot perform well on a diet made up primarily of protein and fat? Where is that? And don't be surprised when you get a deer in the headlight look. Because the only reason people think you need carbs to work out is because it was a fad at one time that became a thing. Right? I mean, really, like, I was told that when I was a kid, that when we were going to do some sort of athletic competition or whatever, to carb up in advance or whatever, so you had energy. But does that make any sense, really? It actually doesn't make any sense at all. Carbs are quick energy. They're not long-duration energy. Long-duration energy is fat. The way the body metabolizes fat allows for it to be drawn on for a long time. Fat is the literal battery that your body stores every bit of reserve energy in. Every bit of reserve energy is stored in fat. Your muscle is built so you can move and you can do things, right? And it is constantly needing to be supplied, right? When your body starts taking muscle, when it starts drawing energy from muscle, that's starvation. You don't have the ability to store carbohydrate in your body at all. All carbohydrate does is raise your blood sugar, and your body has to do everything it can to push the sugar back down to a normal level, a normal operational level. So there's just no basis to this claim at all. None. Nobody's ever proven it. Now, might you say that certain elite athletes that train a certain way might, you know, take 0.2 of a second off their time in the 100 or something? Maybe, but that's not what most people are doing. And I'd still say maybe, because it all depends. It depends on who they are and what they're doing. And I also think it has an awful lot to do, but how long have you been living this new way? the longer you live on a carnivore or ketovore diet, or a full-on lion diet for that matter, the more your body adapts to developing the ability to get its energy from that source of food. I'll also put it to you this way. You know, he mentions Ken. Check out another dude, another doctor, Sean Baker, Thomas DeLauer. Just go look at all the people that live this way and go look at what they look like. And then go listen to your average dietitian. And look at what your average dietitian looks like. I've actually, if somebody could find this out, I would love this piece of information. And then we'll move on to the next thing. I'm doing an estimate by just what I see, saying that more than half of registered dietitians are obese. Not fat, not overweight, obese, full-on obesity. Full-on obesity. I don't see many of them that look healthy. And I usually see either obesity, or I see like this frail, like waif thin, like you can tell not healthy in the other direction from most dietitians. So who should we listen to about diet? The people that are like in their 60s and jacked? Or the obese people who tell you everything the establishment tells you, when you know most of what the establishment tells you is wrong? Why are you choosing to believe the establishment on this, like, this one thing? That's my approach to that. Anyway, let's talk about basic power backup for things like refrigerators and freezers with Sean Mills.
Hey, everybody. It's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead. And today I've got a question from Chris. He says, when building a home battery bank, how do I choose the right battery and inverter? Details. The power goes out every few months, and I am in the dark until I get the generator out of the shed and connect it to my home. I would like a battery bank that would run a fridge, TV, modem, router, and several lights for a day. This would let me hook up the generator at my leisure. Also, I don't have solar, but would like this setup to allow for that addition someday. Thanks, Chris. Well, Chris, you've probably heard me shit on what they refer to as a solar generator. But this is realistically what those devices like the Jackery and the EcoFlow Delta Pro Plus 2000 or whatever, all those devices, like, this is what those things are actually really good at. You essentially use them, you keep them charged up, and then when the power goes out, you go plug your stuff into that and turn it on. Okay, so you could just go buy one of those off the shelf. What you're going to want to know is, in the course of that 24-hour period, that one day, how much power are you actually using for those circuits? And the easiest way to do this is to go get a kilowatt meter or one of the kilowatt meter clones. You can find them all over Amazon. And you buy one of those, you plug it into the wall, you plug your device in it, you come back the next day around the same time, and it will tell you how many kilowatt hours that device used in that 24-hour period. Most of the time, it's going to be point something, right? So 0.250 would be 250 watt hours, or a quarter of a kilowatt hour, okay? So that's the number one thing. Find out how much your fridge, your TV, your modem and router, and your lights that you're planning on using, maybe a things like your computer, you know, laptop battery charger, and your cell phone charger. Just use those things, plug them in for a day, see what that number is. You add all of those numbers up, and let's just say you come up with $2,200 after you've added up, or not $2,200, 2,200 watt hours after you've added those things up. Now you're going to want to go get a device that can give you at least 2,200 watt hours of storage. Now, I would always add 10 to 20% to that number, because these marketing companies, because that's what they really are, they're not technology companies, they're not energy companies, they're marketing companies. They're going to give you information like, we have a 3,500 watt hour battery. They won't give you information like, our device uses 20 watts just to be on, whether you've got anything plugged into it or not. So you got to multiply that number times 24 and subtract it from the battery bank to know how much actual usable energy you have. So, like I said, I would go ahead, take all of your items, add them up, maybe add 10 to 20%. That'll also help cover fluctuations between different seasons, right? In the winter, your refrigerator is probably going to run less because the house ambient temperature is probably going to be a little bit lower, but your lights are going to be on because there's less sunlight during the day, all right? So just add 10 to 20% to that number. Make sure you buy a battery pack that is bigger than whatever that number is.
Remember, if you buy one that's greater than 3,000 watt hours, you're eligible for a tax credit. I've done a full show with Jack on that, so I'm not going to go into details on that here, but just be aware, if you're close to 3,000, it makes sense to jump up to at least a 3,000 watt hour battery bank, because now 30% of that's covered by your tax credit. Then the other thing you want to do is you want to, like you said, look at what can you actually plug into it. So do I need two or three plugs? Can I put solar into it? Does it have a DC charger and an AC charger? You can build one of these on your own. Okay, but you really want to look at how much storage do I have, and then of course the other big number is what's the total output. And so all of these items are rated for a specific output. Let's say it's 3,000 watts. That's another piece of information that you're going to be able to get off of your system. So go ahead, I mean not your system, but your kilowatt meter. So go ahead, when you before you unplug the kilowatt meter, go through the different amp readouts. I think there's like three, and one of those will give you the maximum. Okay, so if it's one amp, you multiply that times 120 volts, and that gives you your actual surge input that the device is going to draw. Okay, and so remember, all of those numbers are going to be multiplied times 120 volts. You want to go ahead and just add all those numbers up. Let's say that they add up to 2,000 watts, not watt hours, because it's not a measurement of time, it's a measurement of surge draw. So then you're going to want to make sure that whatever device you buy has that at least 2,000 watt output rating. So those are the two pieces of information you want. You can get both of those data points from the same device. Just let them run for 24 hours and then check them. And then just go buy the battery bank and inverter all put together into one device. Or you can go buy like an all-in-one inverter with a battery. Make sure you match the voltage up if you do it that way, and you're going to DIY the system. And if you don't buy an all-in-one inverter, then you also want to buy your charger. So I like the all-in-one inverters, like the Renogy 3500 48-volt inverter, because my AC charger and my PV charger are all already built in. I connect everything to one device, and it's smart enough to know how to use those different inputs versus having a dumb inverter, a dumb battery, and a charge controller for AC and a charge controller for DC. So hope that answers your question. You guys keep getting those into Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
All right, good stuff as always from Sean. Let's now turn to foraging expert Kerry Brown, and we're going to talk about foraging the stinky but wonderful Ginkgo biloba.
Hey, TSP community. It's Kerry Brown from Strong Roots Resources, and today I wanted to tell you a little bit about the ginkgo tree, which is also known as the maidenhair tree. These are ancient trees, often referred to as living fossils. There are some in Asia that are over 3,000 years old. They're slow-growing, deciduous trees with a unique fan-shaped leaf and brilliant yellow fall foliage. These trees top out at about 90 feet with a 30-foot spread, and they are hardy in zones 3 through 8 in the U.S. While it's native to northwest China, it's a fairly common landscape planting in much of the U.S., and the female ginkgo is beginning to drop its fruit here in early September. But what we're actually harvesting is the seed contained within its flesh, which, if you didn't know, the flesh has a pretty pungent odor. Some people even say it smells like vomit. So wearing gloves while harvesting is a good idea. It's also a good idea to wait until the flesh covering that nut has dried and then just pick it up from the ground. It's not unusual to find these nuts still on the ground well into winter. Once you harvest the nuts, bake them on low heat for several minutes, and then you can access the seed within the shell. Ginkgo shells aren't hard as hickory or other nuts. I would say they're a little more like a pistachio shell. So there's less effort involved in extracting that edible seed. There's a long list of benefits of ginkgo as well as some cautions. It's best to cook the seed prior to consumption. Raw seeds are believed to be toxic in large quantities, and the seed itself has uses for respiratory support and is a source of niacin, starch, and protein. They're a common ingredient in many Asian dishes as well. Now, the leaves of this tree have uses for cognitive enhancement, improved circulation, and they need to be harvested in the late summer before the color begins to change. Then you can dry them for storage. The leaves are what's contained in most of the ginkgo biloba supplements today, and there's many years of solid research supporting the cognitive boosting benefits of this particular species. Those who are taking SSRI meds, blood thinners, and those who have allergies to cashews should avoid foraging from this tree, and everyone needs to make sure they do their research ahead of time. I just discovered a female ginkgo tree near my training gym, so I'm going to be harvesting some nuts from that site, mostly for planting, as I would really like to have some of these available in my own food forest. I also know of several shopping centers in our area containing the female trees, so you're pretty likely to find them in similar kind of retail areas in your city. This tree prefers full sun, well-drained soil, and it's tolerant of your average suburban conditions, which makes it a pretty popular choice for landscape plantings. My mom's got a male ginkgo tree in her backyard, and it is just stunningly beautiful in the fall. It drops this thick carpet of bright yellow leaves in early October, and you can propagate these trees from new growth cuttings, so this will be a springtime activity, late spring, by rooting them in a compost and sand mix. I've also added some useful links for further reading, and since a lot of folks are turned off by the smell of the ripe ginkgo, that just means that there's more opportunity available for the avid forager. If you'd like to learn more about the wild, medicinal, edible, and otherwise useful species on your land, I offer in-person property walks, foraging classes, consulting, and education, as well as identification, GPS tagging, and documentation of those species on your property. I have a travel radius of 4 hours around Knoxville, Tennessee.
I do have to say that they're just a beautiful tree. I mean, if you've ever seen a really mature one, you can see why they call it a living fossil. It looks like something you would have seen in like a Jurassic Park movie. Just beautiful tree, in spite of the fact that the fruit covering the nuts is absolutely horrible smelling. It really is. I don't know about vomit, but not good is definitely the truth. Next up, let's get a little bit of a history and mixology lesson on the use of spirits in health elixirs over time with Kerry Brown.
Hello, this week's topic is from Cheryl, who asked a question on drinkeatlearn.com. Ken, just wanted to say thanks for the bitters and sous vide info. Excited to hear your next segment. FYI, love old fashions, but I'm more interested in dual-purpose medicinals that also taste great. Thanks, Cheryl. And to everyone who has contacted me in the last few weeks, I've been humbled and honored by the tremendous response and excitement behind what I do. Big thank you to everyone. Also, I'm just getting over a cold, so the voice is a bit rough. So let's get to Cheryl's question. Disclaimer, I am not a doctor, botanist, or any other professional that can give advice on medicinal properties for any ingredient. I will always urge you to educate yourself and consult with a medical professional. So with that out of the way, let's do some real quick history on the subject that I love, anthropology of spirits. Learning about what we were drinking throughout history really tells the story of civilization. I'm going to leave tons out for time's sake, but here we go. So the first mixologist was Hippocrates. Well, not really, but he did discover and teach the usage of roots, herbs, and other natural ingredients in his practice. These ingredients spoiled, so to preserve them, he suspended them in an alcoholic solution. These ingredients seeped their essential oils over years of sitting in containers, and most of them tasted horrible. This technology spread into Rome and the Roman army, and as they conquered the lands throughout Europe, so spread this early apothecary technology. Some sources have found these old apothecary elixirs and infusions still in use during World War II in Eastern Europe. Anyway, they tasted horrible, and in Italy, these early primitive doctors would tell patients suffering from stomach ailments to take some specific elixir from some root that was incredibly bitter before or after a meal. To make it palatable, generous amounts of sugar, herbs, extra booze was added. So yes, indeed, a spoonful of sugar does make the vitamin go down. Soon, this practice just turned into a cultural habit, and so was born the aperitif and digestif. These now common spirits are regularly taken as a cocktail, but had medicinal uses in the past. Now enters vermouth, the most amazing spirit that's often overlooked. And yes, the vetted bartender or mixologist uses it on an often basis, but for the most part, it's not common practice. Vermouth is wine infused with herbs, roots, etc., and then it's fortified with a heavier spirit. It's historically made with wormwood. Yes, wormwood, the same from the infamous spirit absinthe, fabled to make you go mad or crazy from something called thujone. More on this later. So, in this scenario, I want you to consider vermouth as a technique versus a spirit. When you think of vermouth at home, here's how you do it. You could take any herb, tea, root, and infuse them into wine. I avoid fruit in this extraction. As far as extraction alcohol, I prefer a white wine like Sauvignon Blanc or Pinot Grigio. But you can also do this with cider and even sake. I'm not really worried about how sweet it is. You're going to adjust this later on. You guys know me, and usually I would throw this in a sous vide, fast extract, and be done. But not this time. The wine, cider, or sake is low ABV, so it's not going to extract as quickly as something like Everclear, which is at 95% ABV. And if this were to be extracted too fast, it's difficult to control the potency of ingredients. Okay, grab a large mason jar. After considering what ingredients you want to extract based on a cocktail idea or medicinal uses, I suggest making many packets of cheesecloth with each ingredient, and I take a thin string with a little label for each packet. Why? Each one will extract at different rates, and some can get wickedly strong, while others may take a long time to get the flavors out. You can more easily pull out these specific ingredients if it's separated than try to fish it out piece by piece. Place each ingredient inside the mason jar, hang the strings and labels over the lip. Now fill the mason jar with whatever spirit you decide to use, whether it's wine, cider, or sake. Top it, tighten the lid, and place it in the refrigerator. I'm trying to avoid oxidation and spoilage of any ingredient. Gently shake every day or so. Taste to see how the ingredients are coming together. If you taste something becoming too strong, pull it out. After weeks or months, you've got a beast of an extraction. And when you feel it's ready, you'll want to pull the packets out, and you'll need to add some sugar and some strong brandy. You can really use whatever spirit you want. It needs to be potent, though, right? At least 40% ABV, but best around 60 or plus. You're making this as sweet or dry as you'd like, so add sugar as much as you'd like based on your taste. Over time, this concoction matures and oxidizes, meaning you'll taste notes like fig and raisins. And if you've added enough high ABV to the spirit, you can throw it into an oak barrel for finishing. So when you're done, label, refrigerate. You can drink this chilled, neat, add it to mineral water, you can make craft cocktails, and yes, you can even cook with it. So lastly, let's chat about using ingredients that can be toxic. I recommend finding local herbalists, foragers, botany clubs to learn about your local ingredients or how to cultivate these ingredients on your homestead. For instance, there was a huge craze over absinthe in the late 19th century. Absinthe contains wormwood that has an active ketone called thujone that can be highly toxic. Tons of misinformation was spread, and which scares a lot of people that have no experience in botany or herbalism, or especially people in the late 19th century. The U.S. no longer allows wormwood in vermouth or absinthe, but the EU does in small amounts. Now here's the kicker. In most cases, there's more thujone in sage than there is wormwood. So learning about these natural ingredients is vastly important to become safer in the application. It's much like mushroom foraging. I do not suggest going out and foraging for mushrooms without some education or mentorship from individuals who are vetted in the field. When you start extracting oils from any ingredient, there's a concentration, and it's much different than just eating a small piece. So in this instance, I suggest you learn from those who have years of experience in the field of herbalism and botany, which is definitely not me. Become a subject matter expert on what you want to grow on your homestead or foraging, and for what medicinal purposes you want to use them for. There are tons of techniques besides this vermouth technique to add some flavor into your health elixirs or cocktails, and I am certainly here to help. Cheryl, I hope this helps you. Everyone else, keep those questions coming in. Until next time, this is Ken Daniels with DrinkEatLearn.com. Cheers.
I thought that was a fascinating segment. Really fascinating. And I am so glad that we have kind of recently expanded the expert council and that he's part of it. That was just a fantastic deep segment, you know, and the segment by Carrie just before that, again, these are new guys to the council. They're bringing a lot of new material, new stuff to cover to the show. And I want to thank both of them and all the expert council members, but also all the newest ones like Andy, et cetera. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead. And now we're going to hear from Old Dog Bones, who's been with us a long time as an expert council member. And he's going to talk about mpox, a.k.a. monkeypox.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, still the number one ranked book on emergency medicine on Amazon, by the way, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Keeping an eye out for future pandemic diseases, well, that's part of our mission as medical preparedness advocates. Sometimes the concern is significant, as it was in January 2020 when we first reported on what would eventually be called COVID, and sometimes not so much as with last spring's avian flu. This time it's a viral disease known as Mpox, which is short for monkeypox. The World Health Organization, or WHO, has declared a public health emergency of international concern due to this virus. So what is monkeypox? Monkeypox is an orthopox virus related to variola, also known as smallpox. It was first identified in humans in 1970. The various types are divided into two clades. A clade is a group of organisms with a common ancestor. Clade 1 is generally considered more transmissible and more severe than clade 2. Clade 2, however, was responsible for the 2022 outbreak, totaling 100,000 cases, including a number in the U.S., but only a 0.2% death rate. The death rate of clade 1 is thought to be somewhat higher, but the number is uncertain and doesn't reach Ebola-level heights. A special concern is that the current clade 1 outbreak affects children under 15 years of age more than any other age group. In 2024, tens of thousands of clade 1 patients have been identified in Africa, although only a quarter have been definitively testing, I'm guessing due to poor access to advanced medical care. Of these, 650 have died, almost all in the Democratic Republic of Congo. A handful, however, have been documented in Sweden, Thailand, and Pakistan in travelers that have recently returned from Africa. I want to say as an aside that the World Health Organization has decided to change the name from monkeypox to Mpox for a number of reasons, the most coherent of which is that it's not absolutely certain what animal actually passes the disease. African rodents seem to be just as likely to pass the virus as primates. So what are the signs and symptoms of monkeypox? After an incubation period of as little as a day to as long as 3 weeks, symptoms of Mpox become pretty obvious. Common signs include a nodular, itchy, and sometimes painful rash, fever and chills, a sore throat, headache, muscle aches, lethargy, and swollen lymph nodes. The telltale rash is pretty distinctive, starting as flat splotches and turning into firm nodules, then turning into a blister filled with pus before eventually scabbing over. The lesions can appear on the hands, feet, chest, face, or even the genitals. Like many viral diseases, an infected person may be contagious for several days before showing physical signs of illness. You can expect symptoms to last probably 2 to 4 weeks, but they may last longer in those with weakened immune systems. So how does monkeypox or Mpox spread? It's not absolutely certain how animals spread the disease to humans, but being scratched or bitten is likely. Consuming bush meat from infected animals, that's another possibility. Human-to-human transmission occurs through close contact. This includes body fluids or skin lesions, but even breathing close to one another may cause sickness, as could exposure to contaminated clothing or bedding. Mpox may also be spread from mother to fetus. Of course, close contact can also mean sexual contact. The 2022 outbreak of clade 2 was thought to be spread in great part to sexual contact among men. No effective treatment has yet been approved for Mpox, but keeping the patient well hydrated with IV fluids, that's important and seems to lower the severity of cases and the death rates, as it did with the 2014 Ebola epidemic in West Africa. In addition, there are some antivirals and immunoglobulins that are being used in certain cases. One antiviral therapy is called tecovirimat, and that's available for treatment of severe cases only. It's not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration, however. The first Mpox vaccines are now out and are related to smallpox vaccines. Two doses are required the second 4 weeks after the first. An 80% effectiveness rate is claimed, although it takes several weeks for an effect to be noted. It may be effective even after exposure, however, which is a good thing. As with all new vaccines, however, we still don't know enough to determine their true safety profile. Do your research. As of mid-September 2024, no cases of monkeypox have yet been identified in the United States. Therefore, I don't think it's going to have a major impact on you and yours. But viruses often mutate, so it requires containment efforts where it exists now in Africa, and of course, further research. And, by the way, you need to be vigilant and keep track of any and all infectious diseases that emerge anywhere and anytime. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. And remember, medic, do what you can with what you have where you are. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
I will say that I am more concerned about the algae in my fish tank than I am about monkeypox. That's how I feel. I'm just not concerned at all, even a little bit. And if they try to turn it into some sort of pandemic bullshit with restrictions, they can kiss my ass. I am never giving an inch on this issue ever again. Anyway, moving on from there, let's talk about what I need to help you guys out with today. Mark emailed me, and this is what he said. I have about 12 Jersey Giant hens that I've had for two... hold on, let me back up there. Bottom line up front, there has to be a better way to identify fertilized eggs. What can I do to ensure chicken eggs are not fertilized before they're stored and eaten? If you have a rooster, you're not going to do that. We'll go through some of Mark's thoughts here on that. I have had 12 Jersey Giant hens for 2 to 3 years and have been blessed with a surplus of eggs each year. Understanding that my hens were in their last real egg-laying cycle, I got a barred rock rooster and taught him not to be a dick. That's a good way to be. I do not incubate eggs. I prefer to let nature manage the process, but I would still like to collect the unfertilized ones. I immediately stopped collecting eggs, which means I have a bunch of piles in nests. I have 2 chickens, so at least nature knows what they have to do. Not wanting to eat fertilized eggs, I looked into candling and attempted, but it cracked 1 egg. This morning, there was not only fertilized, it appeared further along in the process. It is not so difficult to candle, but I guess you need to wait 7 days. If I do that to determine the egg is fertilized, I can't assume I cannot just stick it back in the nest. Fortunately, even broody Jersey Giants seem to be very gentle birds. Flock management. So do I need more than one rooster, and I want to have confidence the eggs are collected are unfertilized? I could conceivably split young hens from the rooster, assuming, of course, that I get some hens. I'm dissatisfied with my egg collection practices, which since the rooster's arrival have resulted in many wasted eggs. I may try to build another coop, assuming my rooster buddy and my hens breed enough to provide me with 3 or 4 hens. I think maybe the easiest path would be to eliminate the rooster and remaining hens from the flock. Any related suggestions are greatly appreciated, Mark. Okay, so for some reason, Mark's worried about fertilized eggs. And most homesteaders would tell you, if you're going to keep roosters, just stop even using the term and assume that all your eggs are fertilized. And most of them probably are. Most of them probably are. We've had, you know, rooster chicken ratios as high as 12 to 1. And I would still say when I did put eggs in an incubator, you know, I put 32 eggs in an incubator, get 31 hatch. Roosters get around, and they get around well. And you might get some eggs that are bad eggs, and eventually a broody hen will determine that egg is bad, and she'll push it out of the nest herself. So I don't know why you're opposed to eating fertilized eggs. I don't understand that rationale at all, other than maybe there's some sort of religious connotation. If that's the case, then you need to figure out how to basically separate hens that don't get bred, because you're going to be the vast majority are fertilized. The good news is fertilized eggs do perform exactly the same way as a non-fertilized egg does in storage. If you take an egg and you set it on your countertop for 10 days, you might have enough development that when you candle it, you can see a little dark spot. That's about it. If you put eggs in a refrigerator, you're not even going to get that. And so the key with egg management when you have breeding birds and broody birds is to collect all the new eggs every day. And don't leave any eggs except the ones you want to let one of your girls brood for you, okay, once she goes broody. So the way we've always done this, and I'll explain where it becomes a problem, by the way. Usually the case is that that brooding bird is not laying any eggs. Once she sits, she's done. Chickens, ducks, etc., they'll lay eggs, and they'll store them up until they get enough to brood, and they actually stop laying eggs because nature knows what she's doing, and you don't want, like, this week, 5 eggs hatch. Next week, 7 eggs hatch. Next week, 3 more eggs hatch. You want all of those eggs to hatch pretty close to each other. So chickens and other birds will lay eggs in a nest until they get enough, and then they will sit. What happens is her girlfriends are like, oh, look, Henrietta's going to sit on eggs. I know. I'll add eggs. I'll pop eggs on. Sometimes they'll sit right next to each other and literally pop an egg under there. Sometimes they'll come in as relief, like when she needs to go out. Like a lot of times your broodies, they'll leave once or twice a day and they'll go get a little drink or something and they come back. Well, what'll happen is your other girls will see that opportunity. They'll go in there and add eggs. So you're constantly adding eggs, and that can lead to being completely out of sync with what should be going on. And now you have this giant pile of eggs. Some are fertile, some are not. But the bigger problem is they're all off-timed, and often they'll lay so many eggs that the girl sitting can't even cover them all. So there's a very simple solution to this. It's a 50-cent marker called a Sharpie. And all we do is when we get a girl and we know she's committed to going broody and we're willing to let her go broody, we'll basically give her the eggs that we want her to hatch. Unless if she's built a nice nest, she's got a lot of eggs, and she's good, that's fine. But what we'll often do is we will take eggs from her and take all the eggs, because we collect eggs every day. And then we'll decide, okay, if she's going to go broody, we'll give her some fake eggs to keep her there for a day or two. And we'll collect eggs. And then we'll have, let's say we want 10 eggs. We'll give her those 10 eggs. When we do, we'll put dots on them with the Sharpie, kind of all around, like four-sided dots. That's all you need, a little dot. Won't hurt anything. Won't mess up the blem. You put them back under the bird. And so then every day when you go collect eggs from that point on, you pick your broody up and you look. And if you had 10 eggs, there should be 10 eggs there. And if there's more than 10 eggs, you look for the ones without the dots, and you pick those up and you put the bird back on them. That's it. There is zero concern about collecting fertilized eggs unless you have some ethical dilemma with it. You're not going to take an egg and put it in the refrigerator that was collected the day that it was laid, and you know, 2 weeks later when you crack it, or a month later even if you crack it, you're going to find a baby chicken in it. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. The viability of eggs at, like, let's say room temperature where they're not going to develop, you know, again, other than you might get to where you have that little dark spot in there, is generally considered 10 days. So when we're collecting eggs for a broody or for an incubation, that's kind of our benchmark. I've seen it 14 days and 100% hatch, right? I've had people tell me they've done it as long as 20 days. But kind of the industry standard practice, like sort of the homesteader standard practice, is about a 10-day. That's how long you can save up eggs, and then when you put those in the incubator, you'll see. I know you don't use an incubator, but if you did, if it's like, say, ducks, and they're going to hatch at 27 days, those eggs will 100% hatch within 24 hours of each other. Same with chickens at 21 days. Quail, I think it's 18 days. As long as you manage your things that way. So it's instead of trying to identify the fertilized eggs, what you want to do is identify the eggs that were all available to that bird at one time. You probably have a mess on your hands now, definitely. Assuming that the eggs that are in place are not exceeding the size of the chicken's ass and are not like spilling out all over the place, you could mark all of them that you have now and begin this practice. And that's probably what I would do. And by, again, when you do mark them, you want to mark them kind of on all sides, so that you only really handle the new eggs and you don't touch her eggs, and you let her control when they're turned and how they're turned. Once in a while is okay if you need to. If you pick one up and you didn't see the mark and there's the mark, just put it back the way you found it. It'll be fine. But we really don't want to be touching those eggs on a daily basis. And what you'll generally find is if she gets close to where those guys are starting to make some noise back to her and talk to her from inside, she's going to not get up anymore. She's not going to leave that nest at all. She'll stay, like, she'll go in her own lockdown mode for about 48 hours and do without. And she's not going to let other birds in there with her, most likely, during that last phase. So if you keep records, you should know, chicken 21 days from that set, that when you're at about 18, 19 days out, leave her alone. Don't bother her. Let her be in lockdown mama mode. And when she hatches them, if there's a couple eggs under there, they're probably not developed enough to matter. You could just discard them. You could feed them to the dog. If you have another girl grading called Brood, you could certainly give her those. But I wouldn't worry too much about the one or two that might end up under her at the very end. That's it. Again, I've actually never heard anybody in all these years ask me about worrying about the eggs being fertilized. But your problem that you're having, the egg management problem, is very common, and it's the easiest way we came up with to solve the problem. And I have to say, it was my wife's idea. I'm pretty sure other people do it too, though, because it's pretty obvious when you think about it. Anyway, with that, I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. I was glad that I was able to get you at least two new shows this week, even though there's a lot of rewinds and flashbacks. A reminder, there'll be a Friday flashback like every Friday tomorrow, and then Monday there will be one more rewind as I am on my way back from Tennessee. Anyway, guys, take care. And I want to say something here real quick at the end. It seems like when these major disasters hit, there's always when I'm traveling. And therefore, as they're occurring, I don't really get to cover them. And, of course, I'm talking about the hurricane that jacked up Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Tennessee with flooding and all kinds of problems. And part of that also, though, is other than, like, media reporting on it, like, what's actually happening, I don't like to, right when a hurricane happens, start telling people all the things that they should have done to be prepared while they're still digging out. While they're still waiting for the water to recede from their house. Like, I don't think that's the time to be telling people, hey, you should have backup power, you should have gas, you should have food, because there are people, like, stuck right now, and they 2 days are out of food. They have, I don't know how people who live in a place where you can be cut off, because most of this stuff is up in the mountains and what have you, only have 2 days worth of food. I don't even understand it, but I don't think that lady that I read the article on needs to hear that from me right now or anybody in a similar situation. There'll be plenty of time for an after-action review of everything that went down. And we will definitely use it for a future show about what we can glean from, what we can learn from, what really happened to people. That's the best way to know how to prepare. If something happened before, it can happen again. I did a show a long, long time ago, back in 2008, called The Missed Lessons of Hurricane Katrina. We'll probably have something similar with this storm, because there's a lot of missed lessons here. And a lot of the government BS is going on again with telling people they can't carry a gun or something at a time when they most need a gun. By the way, I'm just saying, Florida, do better. Though it's not a state policy, it is local jurisdictions that are doing this BS. In any event, I wanted to acknowledge it, you know, and honestly, everything else you've heard this week, other than the show that I'll be doing tomorrow, which was Tuesday for you, with Nicole, is before the fact. I had all of this prepared before the storm actually hit. So I haven't really had an opportunity to talk to you about it, and I didn't want, as long as I'm gone this week, I didn't want to not say anything. So we will be talking about it in the future again. With that, enjoy your rewind on Monday and your flashback tomorrow, and I'll try to keep my head in sync with what days are what as I'm doing a Thursday show on a Monday. Anyway, guys, I'll be back and re-energized, hopefully, after visiting with some really cool people at Self Reliance Festival on Tuesday. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.